In-depth research from the Pew Center tells us large majorities of people in Muslim countries want more democracy and oppose religious violence, especially groups such as ISIS. Pew also shows that Muslims in Western countries, including the US, are patriotic towards their adopted homelands. But for 40 years, Saudi Arabia has been exporting a purist, even authoritarian form of Islam that blends the Wahhabi and Salafi traditions. Journalist Krithika Vargour investigates this history in a new book, The Call, Inside the Global Saudi Religious Project. And as you'll hear, Krithika reveals the Saudis have had some surprising allies in their quest.
4 years ago, I moved to Australia's neighbor, Indonesia, to work as a journalist. And Indonesia is the world's largest Muslim majority country. And I was reporting on religious fundamentalism and extremism. Through my reporting on these developments in Indonesia, I came to realize that a lot of the key actors and institutions behind religious fundamentalism in Indonesia had some kind of Saudi connection, whether it was the leader of the Islamist guerrilla group or these kind of the Islamist political party. Everyone had graduated from some kind of Saudi-linked institution or otherwise had spent time in the kingdom and so on. And that's why I decided to investigate why this was happening a little bit more coherently as a journalist. And I realized it was part of a much bigger program that dated back to the 1960s of systematic outreach, not just Indonesia, but to dozens of countries around the world, both Muslim majority ones and ones with Muslim minority populations.
As you say, in Indonesia, it's been a long-standing influence by the Saudis, but I did get the impression that that interest had been intensified after the tragedy of the 2004 tsunami. And in fact, Saudi money was instrumental in rebuilding.
That's absolutely right. So the hardest hit part of Indonesia by the tsunami was Aceh, which is a very, very conservative province on the westernmost part of Indonesia. You know, suffered over 100,000 casualties, and a Saudi charity campaign quickly set up shop in Aceh right after the tsunami. And they still have an office as of 2018, which is the last time I was there. They set up orphanages, helped rebuild houses, and built schools, and accompanied these charity efforts with their missionary program, which included scholarships, but also preaching the Salafi kind of Islam. To some extent, I expected to see this when I went to Aceh. What I didn't expect was that the Achenese people put up a resistance to this kind of missionary activity, even though they were so vulnerable after the tsunami. And Aceh is actually one of the places in Indonesia with a very vibrant clash between Salafi or Wahhabi elements and their local Muslim traditions. It's both an example of how Saudi charity works in tandem with its missionary activity, and an example of how not every place that's the recipient of Saudi aid takes 100% of what they have to offer.
You describe Saudi foreign policy, which is deeply entwined with religion, as being, and I do like this image, like throwing spaghetti against a wall and you see what sticks. I mean, that is a very good image. Give me an example of this sort of scattergun strategy that the Saudis employ.
Returning again to Indonesia, it would be impossible to pinpoint one thing that they did there. They really tried everything all at once, starting from around 1965. So not only did they build a brick and mortar Saudi university in Jakarta, which is the capital of Indonesia, but they also created a religious attaché's office, which is associated with the embassy. And it's kind of like a diplomatic post that is supposed to oversee missionary activity. But they also funded the former prime minister to distribute Saudi money as he saw fit. They also funded the creation of schools. They also put preachers on their payroll. They also gave scholarships to study at university in Saudi Arabia. And they also did charity things like the Aceh tsunami relief. So all of these together is part of what I would call the Saudi sphere of influence in Indonesia. And it wasn't as kind of single-minded as you might think, because it had a very broad range of efforts. So when we talk about the Saudi campaign, it's not just one thing like they created terrorists. It's that they tried to do a lot of things, including educational diplomacy and supporting people getting higher education where they might not have otherwise.
The central idea of the Saudis' religious outreach is this idea of dawah. Now, just explain, what is dawah? It's powerful, but it's quite simple.
Dawah is just an Arabic word that means to call or invite, and it means the call or invitation to Islam in practice. So in some ways, a duty of every Muslim to do dawah in the way that they see fit. So it could be as simple as living your life as a good Muslim could be your dawah. But in the Saudi nation state example, Saudi dawah meant systematically trying to spread their state brand of Wahhabi Islam through a variety of different programs around the world.
And it's an important point that you bring out about this clash between indigenous forms of Islam that have often sort of merged with local cultures, have been very healthy expressions of Islam, and what the Saudis have been trying to export.
Absolutely. So in all three of the countries that I took as case studies for this book, Indonesia, Nigeria, and Kosovo, there were very strong and very different religious traditions before Saudi dawah started from the 1960s onward. Sometimes this took the form of Sufism, sometimes it's animistic or syncretic forms of religion, and sometimes it's just a more casual or less literalistic approach to religion in the case of Kosovo. These traditions, when they came into contact with the very literalistic Saudi brand of Islam, there was often conflict engendered by that. Sometimes it was violent, sometimes it was just ideological, but either way, you don't come and bring such an extreme ideology like they were doing and not ruffle some feathers.
Yeah. Well, you don't just bring the ideology, you bring dollars. Do we know just how much money the Saudi government has thrown at religious export, as it were, over the past, say, 20 years, 30 years?
The numbers are very hard to pin down, in part because a lot of internal financial flows are reported only to the monarchy and they're not like necessarily externally accountable. But by one account, the Legacy Foundation of King Fahd, who was a key Saudi monarch, estimated that they spent about $1 billion in dawah between 1982 to 2002. Again, it's self-reported, but I think that's a good ballpark in the sense of how much they were investing in this global project.
Krithika, the Saudis embracing this purist expression of Islam have had a rather interesting partner in their project. What role has the United States played in partnering with the Saudis?
It's a great question. I'm glad you asked. Some of the peak periods of Saudi missionary activity coincided with the United States' Cold War against Russia and their global anti-communist campaign. So in a lot of countries, especially in Asia and Africa, Saudi and U.S. interests went hand in hand. The Saudis wanted to counter communism because they felt like it was a threatening ideology to Saudi leadership of the Muslim world. And the U.S. was threatened by communism in other countries because of the so-called domino effect that they feared would happen. So the U.S.-Saudi relationship is very old. It dates back to the discovery of oil in the Arabian Peninsula in the 1930s. And it's been a very special but strange relationship over time, forged almost exclusively between elites, between presidents, between business executives. There's not a great deal of cultural fellow feeling between Americans and Saudis. But this has been an ironclad relationship and almost a central fact of U.S. foreign relations for almost the whole past century. So in part, the carte blanche that the U.S. gave Saudi Arabia and the implicit backing that they gave was crucial to their missionary campaign. And although the U.S. would later come to see Islamic terrorism as, you know, an enemy in the so-called war on terror, during the Cold War, people like Henry Kissinger actively encouraged the Saudi export of Wahhabism because they thought it would be sympathetic to their own anti-communist projects. Mm-hmm. So what happened in the 1990s and then especially after 9/11 was huge whiplash.
Here on the Religion and Ethics Report with Andrew West, I'm speaking with Krithika Vaghore. She's the author of the new book, The Call, Inside the Global Saudi Religious Project. We know a lot, because we've discussed it quite a bit over the past almost decade on the program, about the United States effectively creating the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and that also being an anti-communist project. But I was fascinated to read about this outfit, which doesn't directly involve the US, but it was called the Safari Club. Tell us about the Safari Club.
That's one of my favorite episodes of Cold War history. It has a whimsical name, but not so whimsical aims. It's named after the ranch in Kenya owned by the famous Saudi arms dealer Adnan Khashoggi, where the U.S. and Saudi officials and leaders from other countries like France met to plan anti-communist escapades throughout Africa. They were very concerned with beating back communism in Africa. And, you know, this kind of fell apart after the Iranian Revolution. It was only a few years that it held together. But this was a part of the high watermark of U.S.-Saudi cooperation on the African continent. And they most feared kind of like spillover effects of initially like Arab socialism, but also just communist movements and revolutionary movements in sub-Saharan Africa. There are a lot of stones left unturned. Adnan Khashoggi, of course, was part of the very prominent Khashoggi family. But this is exactly the kind of elite cooperation that we saw between U.S. and Saudi during the Cold War.
Yeah, wasn't there some shady French count involved also in the Safari Club?
Yeah, and I think he was very interested in places like Angola, for example. And the thing is, with regards to what the Safari Club did on the ground, we know the general picture of places they were acting, such as Somalia, but in order to get the full picture, we need to see some files declassified on the U.S. side, at least.
We know about the Saudi influence in Asia. We know about the Saudi influence now in Africa. We don't quite know much about the Saudi influence in Europe, and particularly in Kosovo, a breakaway state from Serbia, not recognised by the United Nations, but it is recognised by the US. One figure leapt out at me about Kosovo and its relationship to ISIS. What is it?
It was a big surprise to me, too. The Saudi campaign in Kosovo was one of the last, or like the most recent vintage of big Saudi campaigns. It was, I would say, one of the last ones before 9/11. So it started in December 1998, towards the tail end of the Yugoslav wars, when Saudi aid started supporting Kosovars, and continued up until, you know, through the 2000s. Part of that time, Kosovo was administered by a UN body, and there was very little, you know, central oversight. So there were a lot of Saudi preachers doing their thing and spreading Salafism on the ground. But it didn't really become, you know, a topic of international concern until about 2014, when a surprising number of young Kosovar men started emigrating to join ISIS. Kosovo is populated by ethnic Albanians, who are historically a quite secular people. And Yugoslavia, of course, was a communist state, was not very religious. And the question was, where did this come from? How did so many young people in Kosovo emigrate to ISIS? Actually, the highest number per capita in all of Europe, higher than Belgium and France. And the answer, in large part, you know, in my research, is because Salafism spread like wildfire right after the fall of the Yugoslavia, thanks in part to Saudi Dawah, which was instrumental in rebuilding the religious life of Kosovo after the Yugoslav wars. When we think of Kosovo independence, I think most of us would think of U.S., because the U.S. led NATO bombing is what led to its independence, and the UN administered it. But neither the US nor the UN were really looking out for like Kosovar's religious life, and they left that playing field wide open for Saudi and Gulf actors. The consequence of that is that so many of the most influential preachers and imams in Kosovo got scholarships to study in Saudi Arabia, and what they teach is a very Saudi-inflected brand of Islam. And that is why Salafism spread within less than two decades so fast within this small country that people started becoming jihadists.
Yeah, well, an interesting example of the purification that the Saudis insist on was the destruction of certain Ottoman heritage, because the Saudis told the Kosovars, and this is, you know, the Ottomans, probably one of the most successful Islamic periods in world history, that it wasn't Muslim enough.
This idolatry and destruction of tombs and monuments is one of the central tenets of Wahhabism. In some ways, you can compare this instinct to maybe like Calvinism, if that makes sense as an analogy. It's very anti-iconography. So the Wahhabis in the original 18th century and context destroyed some of the most important heritage sites inside Saudi Arabia. They almost destroyed the Black Kaaba, which is the direction in which all Muslims pray around the world. That's how against monuments they were. Luckily, they didn't get to destroy that World Heritage Site, but that is the approach they take. So when they got to Kosovo, they encouraged the destruction of these beautiful Ottoman graveyards and rebuilt these mosques that had been shelled in a kind of very bland Gulf style instead of the more regionally specific Ottoman style. So a lot of cultural heritage of Kosovo and the Balkans was lost in this process.
Let's talk about Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince, a man who's tried to present himself as a liberal reformer. I guess you're not sold on that image.
I'm not sold on this image. A month or so after I sold my book proposal, Jamal Khashoggi was murdered in a Saudi consulate. I was worried at one point when I started writing this book, maybe it'll become irrelevant because of Vision 2030. I was very quickly disillusioned from that particular prospect. MBS is a lot of things. He is a modernist. He is a, you know, reformer. I believe that he is sincere in some of his intentions. But the way he's carried out his actions is callous at best and egregiously awful at worst. And in terms of Wahhabism, he has made a big show of arresting clerics and claiming to present a new moderate face of Saudi Islam in the world. So it's obvious that he's very sensitive to the reputation that Saudi has developed as this kind of fountainhead of extremism. But when you look at the people he's actually put in jail, the people he's actually reprimanded, it is not the most ideologically fervent Wahhabi clerics, but it is the reform-minded people, the people who've called for tolerance of religious minorities, people who called for human rights liberalization, who MBS has put in jail. He is not some kind of anti-Wahhabi. He is very much still a Wahhabi. He is a member of the House of Saud, and his family has a pact dating back to the 18th century with the Wahhabi clerics, and he very much still has to uphold that pact, even if he says things to the contrary. In terms of the promise of Vision 2030 in modernizing the religious establishment, I'm not super hopeful. But despite whatever he says, the one thing that I do think might change the Wahhabi campaign and has already is the fact that their oil revenues are not what they used to be. So whether or not they want to continue the Saudi project, they're no longer as flush with money as they were in the late 20th century. So that has necessarily handicapped a lot of their projects around the world.
Krithika Vargoor, she's the author of the new book, The Call, Inside the Global Saudi Religious Project. It's part of a Columbia Global Reports series of books. Krithika, thank you very much for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.